Hello, it's Paul from The Pass Podcast, here to tell you that Series 3 of The Pass is sponsored by the wonderful people at Sous Vide Tools. Hello, we're back. It's the first proper episode of Series 3 of The Pass Podcast. It's your very good friend, Mr. Paul Newbegin, here with this episode, as promised, from Obsession, which, if you don't know, is an event that happens at Northcote every single year, in which Nigel Howarth and Lisa Allen Goodwin invite sort of top chefs, really amazing caliber chefs from all over the UK, all over the world, to come and cook, and they cook a menu at Northcote. And guests can come and buy tickets to certain days, and there'll be wine pairings, which we're going to be talking about in this episode. And so, yeah, there's going to be a multitude of chats, first of which is with, of course, none other than Nigel Howarth. Wow, what a fantastic chat. Here we go.
Obsession started going back to 2000 when I just got in a casual conversation with one of our customers about a festival of food and wine in Monterey. And of course we're in the deepest, gloomiest Blackburn in the middle of bloody winter, and he said to me, oh, you should go over. And I thought, it sort of stuck in the back of my head, and I thought, I will go because it's a lot warmer over there. And it would be nice to go and work with all the top American chefs. So basically the festival that they were running at the Highlands Inn in Carmel at that time was was like one of the biggest festivals in the US, but the biggest festival in California. And they had all the top chefs, you know, the Thomas Callis, the Alice Waters, the late Charlie Trotter, etc., etc. And I just went over there and did a week working with them. And then ended up going to Thomas Keller's because he invited us for lunch. And I just bummed in a mate's place, slept on the floor. And on the way back, I missed my flight and I had a bit of time. And I was in the airport, I was thinking, what if I could do something like this at Northcote? I said, you know, January and February is a real pain. Lose a lot of money. I wonder if I could do something that might just bring a bit of cheer and actually something for the customers, the local. I didn't do it for, you know, for people from far away. I actually did it for our customers to see if I could give them a reason for coming to Northcote in January and February, because it used to be really bleak, you know, 20 years ago. I started, and I just judged the Pierre Tattinger competition with Phil Howard. So I asked Phil, and he said, yeah, no problem. I'd done a TV programme with Nick Nairn, so I asked Nick, and Terry Laybourne was an old mate of mine. So I asked Terry, I said, would you come and do it with me? Yeah. And funnily enough, I thought that I couldn't actually see or perceive how I could fill my night, because I thought, well, why would people want to come to me? Because ultimately they can come to me anyway.
Yeah,
so that's how little I got my head around the whole theatre and the concept of actually doing it. I thought, well, why would it? Anyway, so I got Charles Metcalf to buddy up with me, and I did a Rioja night just to make sure.
Because obviously, Nigel Howarth, it's not big enough a draw to have.
No, that was the psychology. I just couldn't get my head around why people would actually want to come and do a night with me. Yeah, and that is,
why would you want to come and be one of the best chefs in the UK?
That's bizarre, isn't it? But yeah, anyway. So we started it and we did four nights, and it was, you know, pretty successful. We did 50 a night. And I just said to the team, well, let's roll it. Let's roll it. Let's do it next time. And I think we did the same four nights the year after. And then we rolled it on up to the year seven. We did seven nights, and I can't actually remember why I did seven nights, but it just seemed, there's these numbers that roll through as we went through the years that seem an automatic thing to pair up. So on 10, we did 10 nights, on 7, we did 7 nights, and then the next lump was on 15, because we'd always done 10 nights, and then on 15, we did 15 nights, and that was the big turning point, because I also said I wanted to go take it global. So I had to get flight partners somehow, And I was trying to get BA, and I remember we entertained BA, but they said no.
And then I wonder why they said yes to coming along to be entertained
by you guys
in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. I always remember it because they entertained Harry Styles' dad.
Yeah.
I always thought that was a bit bizarre. I thought Harry Styles' dad can't be like somebody that would be economically useful to me. But anyway. So
he's in the kitchen tonight, isn't he, Harry?
he could be. Anyway, so we managed to get a company called Gold Medal Travel, who were owned by Emirates. We managed to get them interested, and fortunately, we got them on board. And so once we got them on board, from a point of view of being a bit more global, that meant we could fly people in from Japan, Australia, anywhere in Asia, you know, the South Americas and that sort of thing. So it started to open and take Obsession into another dimension. And then here we are at 18, halfway through 18, feeling a bit frazzled, to be honest.
Is it one of those things that it kind of gets easier year on year because it's obviously so well established?
Yes, it does. And you know what? The whole thing's evolved. You know, we had a crappy kitchen. It was freezing cold in the kitchen in winter, and obviously we do it in winter. The stove didn't, only half of the stove worked, and blah de blah de blah, the ventilation was awful. So from that point of view, and then of course the staff, now we've had staff that have travelled with us through the 18 years of Obsession. So they all know what they're doing, and so things happen automatically, and the platform is there. And I'm staggered sometimes. There's nothing for me to do. So the chefs come.
That's perfect.
Yeah, it is. And you sort of take that some nights, and you sort of say, I'll have some of that, because it's a long track, is 18 nights. And, you know, some days are easier than others, and that's probably the way it should be. But the platform's set. My secretary, Amanda, does all the flights and the travel. Kay Matthews, who's our marketing director, does all the marketing, the coordination, the chasing chefs for menus and recipes and all that sort of thing. Lisa Allen, who's been with me 16 years, not 18, but 16, she coordinates all the orders. So there ain't a right lot left for me, so I get the chefs basically and take all the glory.
What I like as well is it does seem like the guests that you're getting, they're quite current guests as well. There's a real mix of people that I remember last year, James Close, and that was the year that he was really rising to prominence.
Yeah, I try and do that, Gary Usher this year. And Gary, you know, something like Gary was so humble. And I said, Gary, you are on point at the moment. Don't give me any bullshit about, you know, you're not this, you're not that. Michael O'Hare the year before. When I go out there, I'm looking for radical, I'm looking for interesting, I'm not just looking for Michelin stars. Because to be honest with you, looking for Michelin stars is a bit boring, and it's a bit sort of tunnelled. I think I'm looking for people who are interesting personalities that can cook really well, because that's what turns Obsession on for me. I've got a gang of Mexicans here who just are incredible personalities. They are big, big personalities, but fucking good cooks, you know. And they, you know, there's some are from Mexico City, some are from the Bayo in California, in Baja California in Mexico. And you just, you know, it lights the place up, you know. But having said that, last night, Larry from Petrus was cooking, and it went down an absolute storm. So it's a real balance, and then we'll have a 3-star from Japan. You know, it is something for everybody. But the customer base is built up on a solid following locally, and then people travel up from Bournemouth and Brighton, and come down from Scotland, and come from Norfolk, and you know. So I don't know where they're all coming from, but it is very much something that's been built on very solid foundations, so every year it just automatically grows because it's full every year. And when you've got something, touch wood, that works and it's full every year in January and February, you have a big smile on your face.
Yeah. One of the things I sort of wonder as well is obviously I've followed your career for as long as I've been interested in food, and you have this real philosophy behind your cooking, and then the people that you're getting in are obviously going to have very different philosophies. So do you kind of like to sort of challenge yourself while those people are in? And
scare myself, I think, sometimes. Yeah. No, I'd still challenge myself with doing new dishes every year, which scares me to death and then challenges me, but it's what it's all about. You know, sometimes I wake up scratching my head thinking, how am I going to balance that caviar? How am I going to get that? Because I don't want to do the obvious. I want to also be a bit edgy with some, with elements of my food. And that then brings in all these guys that come in that, the Russians are cooking with spinal cord. So there'll be a few people walking around Russia with no spinal cords. I'm sort of thinking that where are they getting all these spinal cords for 100 covers? So the Berezovsky twins are cooking for the... We've never had Russian cooks, right. So that's a first. And they're in the world's top 50. And they're going to cook some interesting food. We've got the... cooking with the Mexicans here, Klaus, is the ex sous chef from Geranium in Copenhagen, and he's just putting together some lovely things with octopus and langoustines, and I'm just watching that and fascinated, and it's so inspiring, and then you've got Tom Kitchen and his guys putting these massive Orkney scallops back in the shell with a bit of classic velouti. So how can you not get intrigued and excited with that? And these guys that work with me in the kitchen are so lucky.
But it seems to me as well, because I don't mean to make you feel old, I'm sorry, but your name was one of the first when I became interested in cooking that that I kind of found through shows like Great British Menu and shows like that, and I can remember you competing on those shows.
Yeah, 2008-09, yeah.
And that very moment when you walked towards me then, I just went really nervous. And I wondered, did these other guys get nervous around you?
I don't know.
I'm relaxed now, by the way.
Yeah, I don't know, because you don't know yourself. I don't expect anybody to get nervous, and I don't feel that I should make anybody nervous. But it's a bit like everybody's psychology is different. I mean, when I meet famous people or interesting people or great craftsmen, then there is a stir and says, you admire those people, don't you? Because I think particularly with a craftsman that sticks at something, and I think Craig and I are ambassadors at sticking at things, 35 years here in the backdrop called Lango means that we persevere. So, I think from that point of view, we're sort of ambassadors for the area. Whether anybody reveres us, I'm not quite sure. It's obviously you do, but you might be one of few, or one of many.
Not.
I don't know. We created something. I think we created something really special here, and we did that from the ashes. So we came to a very late, sort of a very rundown country house hotel that lots were going into in the sort of 80s and 70s and then into the 90s. Country house hotels were sort of well documented, and all chefs, lots of chefs. My old mentor Michael Quinn, who sadly passed away last year, he Gravetye Manor was his country house hotel. And we built this from the ashes, really. And now you've got this remarkable place that I think is fit for purpose. And I think that's also testament sort of to sticking at it. And, for young chefs, you sometimes have to grit your teeth and get through the tough times, because there is some tough times, and stick at it, really.
I mean, I've always known roughly where you were. It's my first visit today, but I was driving last year to Freemasons at Wizzle.
Yes.
And we drove straight past here. And I said to my partner, wait, turn around at that roundabout. And we turned around at the top roundabout and just drove around the grounds, because I had to come in and see. And it struck me at that point that this area, let alone the UK, this area has really grown in terms of restaurants in the last sort of few years. Has that been sort of nice for you to see? Or
yeah, it has. It has. And I think, particularly, when you mentioned Steve at the Freemasons, particularly pubs, We've got some great pubs in the area. You know, the Inn at White Wolf, Freemasons, Three Fishes. You know, it's three real bastions of British cookery from a pub point of view. Restaurants, you know, sadly there was the demise of the Longridge restaurant, which I think was sad, and, you know, Paul's a big mate of mine, because that kept us all, you know, we fought and battled to, you know, to each, you know, not outdo each other, but there was a competitive element. Mark Birchall's just opened Moore Hall. Talking of pubs, as a protege of mine, Tom Parker, who's at the White Swan at Fens, another, you know, he cooks really well. And then you've got, you know, not too far away, because the Lake District's only an hour away, you've got all the Lakes, you know, one stars, of which there are many, and you know, very, very good they are. And then you go up to Cartmel to Longclune, and Simon Rogan is still cooking. You know, everybody that goes there just says it's fantastic.
So does it make you want to, you know, keep your game as high as it is?
It does. It does, and we always strive to better and to year on develop what we're doing, and we're doing that with, you know, from a point of view of the kitchen to the gardens to every aspect of the service. We're always trying to improve, and I think, you know, anybody that's you know, that's focused on hospitality, you know, does that. It's a natural thing. You just keep trying to improve, but also trying to balance that with looking after the staff and making sure that, you know, these days in particular, the staff are more and more important. I'm not saying they weren't important before, but you just somehow didn't. You just worked, and whatever happened happened. Whereas now you're actually focused on making sure that these guys get a good lifestyle, and that they're motivated and happy to come into work the next day. And I think that's important.
One of the things that I ask all of my guests, and you'll be a fantastic one to ask this question, is about your ultimate sort of chef hack, your top tip for myself and the listeners to improve our cookery.
That is a good question. Well, I mean, for me, to improve your cookery, it's, I mean, you have to love what you do, and you have to appreciate good ingredients. And I think those two components in cookery, I think, are the most important. So being motivated to cook and enjoying cooking. I mean, if you're cooking at home, you've got to be organised, because if you're not organised, cooking can be difficult. And I think cooking at home should be therapeutic, should be enjoyable. And I say to this to lots of people doing dinner parties, get organised, you know, and give yourself a chance to enjoy what you're going to cook. Because, you know, there's lots of people try and do adventurous food at home and then end up with their hand in ice because they've burnt themselves or whatever else. And, you know, so my top tip is to get organised if you're going to cook at home. And if you're going to enjoy it, and make sure you do enjoy it, because food is about enjoyment. Food is such a wonderful thing, and we're so fortunate at this moment in time to be able to get all these wonderful ingredients from our beautiful island that we live in and from far away. But I think particularly we're now tuned in to trying to rear and grow better ingredients, and we're at a fortunate time when we can all afford to enjoy eating out more and more. So when you do cook at home, get organised, make sure you do the work and the thought and the brain surgery the day before, and then when you're cooking on the day, you'll enjoy it. So my big tip is to read through, have a look, and get organised.
One of the things I've kind of learned doing these series of interviews with chefs is you're not a particularly nostalgic bunch.
Yeah.
You prefer looking forward to looking back, but I do want you. Well, maybe you can buck that trend, because I want you to look back at your career. And how do you sum it up? How, you know, when you do look back, how do you kind of define what you've achieved?
I think just being fortunate that, you know, I came home. I then, by a quirk of fate, met Craig, and we've had a fantastic partnership for 35 years. That has to be fortunate. So I look back on it with a, you know, with a warm glow, to say that you know, we've created something that will be here now. You know, we've created a succession plan is in place, so that Northcote can carry on and keep people happy well into, you know, the 20s. And I think that's important. So when I look back with great fondness on a lot of staff that have given me blood, as we used to call it. you know, including my own son. We've had lots of good times. We've had lots of scary times. We've had lots of times when we sat after a busy service and felt gutted because we've made mistakes. But I think you grow from them. So I look back with a real warmth to say that, you know, in a sort of what we call a backdrop of Langor, we've created something that's interesting and can is strong enough now to keep moving forward, and you know, won't be one of those restaurants that happen and then disappears. And I think that's important for British cookery.
I wondered if I could bring it back for to obsession for my last question and ask you if, for the next year, if there was one chef that you could work with as your headline booking for the next year, who would you choose?
Right. Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, the one chef I'm working on is Massimo Bottura. Now, whether I get him for 2019 or 2020, that's the question. But I've been chasing him for 2 years now, and I'm like a dog with a bone. I don't let go. To highlight that, I travelled to Brazil, to São Paulo, to meet Alex Atala, and I got Alex Atala to say yes, and then he reneged a month later, and it's just too far to get a bus ride to Brazil to sort of challenge his decision.
Give him a clout.
Yeah, but he's another guy that I admire. So I'm looking big now, you know, and but also, not forgetting that, I might get Massimo Bottura, I might get Alex Attal, I might invite Heston Blumenthal back, but it might then, they might be, you know, the night, the day after or the day before, they might be on with, you know, a street vendor from Hong Kong.
Well, I was going to say,
I wondered if there was like a rising star as well that you had your eyes on, like a little top tip for...
Well, I've got Tommy Banks in on Thursday this week.
Yeah.
And I think Tommy's, you know, he's probably, in some people's eyes, probably risen. But Tommy's a Yorkshire lad, very spirited, yeah. and but has shown that he's a great cook and a very nice guy. So, you know, he's my, you know, Gary Husher was my bit of controversy, and he's out there, and I love him to bits. But Tommy Banks is my rising star. He's the guy that's the Mr. Nice Guy of Yorkshire that's cooking really well, and I've got him on the list. So, you know, I'm very lucky. And it might, like I say, it might be that it might be a rising star, because I was talking to a chap yesterday who's worked extensively in Copenhagen, and I said, if I didn't go for the obvious in Copenhagen, because I'm travelling over there on my search for chefs, I said, who would I pick? And he said, oh, there's this certain chap that I think is a better cook than them all. So that's how I go. I have a look, I sort of smell out what might be happening on the street, and then, you know, you try and find somebody who isn't the big name, but that could be in 2 or 3 years' time, and you were there, and you made it happen. And I think obsession's a little bit, you know, it's about giving people a platform, because so many chefs are watching Obsession now, and we're doing much more digital coverage, so it means that we can get across the barriers. And, you know, we're doing Facebook Live now, we're going out to, you know, you could be in Australia listening to us, so... Not that there may be many in Australia.
What do you want to say?
Probably watching cricket. But yeah, it's somebody's having a good time. Don't forget as well, the one thing I have forgot to say is that one of the most important things about our success is the fact that the wine that Craig does has been so successful.
If I get 2 minutes of his time, I'm going to try and chat to him.
Absolutely.
About that,
and the wine marriages, the wine pairings, do make Obsession work, because without those, Obsession wouldn't be as rich.
So, mate, I don't know what to say really to wrap this up. I don't want it to finish because this is just a joy and a pleasure thank to talk you. To you. Just thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul.
So, yeah, up next for Obsession, I grabbed some of Craig Bancroft's time. He's really instrumental in a lot of things that happen at Northcote, and we kind of take a step back from the cooking side, and we talk about the wine pairing side, because he's a bit of a wine expert, and he'll talk us through all the different things that he likes, sort of techniques that he does in a wine pairing. So, enjoy.
Funny enough, you might have a difficult introduction to this podcast, because Nigel has literally just said that your wine pairings make this event.
Well, it's very kind of him.
Where's your sort of first thought go to when you're trying to match wine to a dish?
Really, probably, if I've done it before. So it's the principal ingredient if we used it before. But I'm often asked why we do wine matching so well, and it's primarily because I'm greedy. It's not actually because I'm a wine expert. My love is mainly food originally, and then wine had always been in my family, but wine I can't recite vintages and rivers and all that, but I can definitely tell you what goes with oxtail, and that's purely born out of being a foodie first and a wine man second. And I think often in wine, wine experts are incredibly intelligent, they're immensely talented, they know everything about everything, every grape, every soil, every grain, and the sunshine hours, and if it's biodynamic and that, or not, or organic. For me, I just understand what I think goes with a river trout, or with a pike dish, or with a lobster or a crab or whatever, but I probably couldn't tell you about the make of the wine.
Are you almost trying to sort of please yourself then as the foodie?
No, I think mainly I'm trying to please the chef by making the food stand out with the wine rather than the wine mask the food. And I think this is really important. We talk about them really as marriages or divorces. So the wine either has to pair seamlessly, so there's sort of no division between the two, or one has to sit above the other or below the other, and I call that a divorce pairing, where the parallel makes them exciting rather than the seamlessness. So it's that sort. So there was a dish yesterday which Larry had done of an omelette with Dorset crab, and the sauce was coconut and lemongrass, and that was really fine. The first wine that we did with it was okay. There was nothing wrong with it. It laid flat, and we changed it to a Voignier from Yves Couillon in the Rhone Valley, and we knew it was tropical. It had a sensation of sort of lychees, passion fruits, that type of thing in the background of the wine, and I knew that'd go with coconut. So I said, well, let's try it. And we tried it. And Nigel just said, well, wow, that's amazing. It's just made the sauce stand on its legs. And that's what you're trying to do.
Especially with events like this, you must, like you've just alluded to there, get chefs that their dishes, it's so different to what you're used to in here pairing wines for. So do you ever have that little moment of panic when you've got someone like Michael O'Hare who wants to do these crazy dishes?
Michael's was actually really good pairings because there's always something in Michael's food that stands out. So that gives you an opportunity to be able to latch onto something and think, right, well that's what we're going to go with. You've got to be careful you don't try and do everything. You can't do everything. You've got to take the principal ingredient and decide that's what we're going to match.
And it must be quite good fun as well.
I know, it's bloody good fun. Over the years, we've matched 1,050 wines, and we've repeated very, very few. And I think the most enjoyable thing is we retaste every day at 2 o'clock. So we have a menu, which we principally decide what wine to pair, and then when we get the dishes at 2 o'clock, we can change our mind because our merchant will bring new wine straight away. So we changed two wines last night at 2 o'clock.
Really? Yeah. Just there and then decided
they
no.
They were good, but they weren't perfect, and we found two better ones. That was the principle.
So what... Do you have like a tick list in your head then to what makes that perfection?
No. Nothing so technical. Do we enjoy it at the end of the day? Well, do we really enjoy the pairing? Acidity is really important. I think people don't really understand that. You need to have good levels of acidity to really bring the food flavours out. If the wine is too acidic or not acidic enough, that can be the real change. So for something like oysters, for example, champagne is the perfect pairing. There is very few things that are better than champagne with oysters. So there are some classical matches that really you struggle to get away from. So in that case, you look for either something similar that no one's ever used before, like Pelorus from New Zealand, which is a method champagne noir sparkling wine from the Cloudy Bay stable, which then is a new thing for the audience because they've not seen that before. Mm. So that's interesting. Or a vintage wine or a Blanc de Blanc wine, rather than just being champagne.
But maybe it's easier to find stuff that, like wines that challenge us as the diner, but are you also trying to look for wines that you quite haven't tasted?
Yeah, we're always looking for out there moments. and really throwing people under a bus as well. Yeah, actually putting things in front of them which they think, wow, I never thought I would enjoy that with that. We're using liqueurs a bit more with desserts because the desserts are, the chefs are, keep using savoury items in desserts, which is becoming bloody troublesome, to be honest. But if you turn to the bar, it gives you a whole another repertoire. So, for example, many years ago, a chef from Austria did quark with cucumber and meringue sales and coriander. And we were struggling with that. But we decided that Hendrick's gin and Mediterranean tonic would hit the spot, and it did amazingly well, actually. So then we've turned our mind to that more and more over the years in terms of, can you use an amaretto? Can we use a tequila? Could you use a Mexel? Could you, various and other forms?
And that must be quite, again, really interesting, that because you're so used to going, well, let's try and find a wine. There must be a wine somewhere. And then, like you say, you can go somewhere completely different with it.
Yeah, you can. I mean, cognac and chocolate is amazing, but the audience don't quite get it. Or rum and chocolate.
Yes.
Really, really brilliant.
Yeah.
But it's a very harsh thing to drink at the end of a meal, but if you're up for it, it really works. Mm. Port and chocolate is brilliant. Port and raisins and hazelnuts and chocolate, that always works. But again, people don't expect you to put a port with a chocolate tart, but it works amazingly well.
Your name is just as much synonymous with this place as Nigel. How do you kind of put down the attributes to the success of this place?
It's down to two passionate people, really, sticking to their guns. We didn't know each other, so we became friends out of the business rather than being friends going into business, which I always say I think was probably the most important thing, because having not known each other, we earned respect from each other for our various crafts. So Nigel had never met anyone like me who was as mad about food as a waiter, basically. And I'd never met a chef I thought was as good a cook in those days. So when he told me things, I understood them completely because I'd been a chef myself. And I think Nigel had always been frustrated with front of house people who didn't really get food. So if he had things to sell, I could just sell it. And then we made sure throughout the life of our business, we demarked it so that I did all front of house and wine and housekeeping and the hotel side of it, and Nigel did gardens, back of house, and all of the kitchens, and we never crossed.
I say to quite a lot of people that ask me, oh, I'm looking for that little extra special place to go to, a hotel to stay at, a restaurant to eat at, and I always say, do you know what, if you're looking for somewhere and you're not that knowledgeable, go on the Relay and Chateau website, have a look through and decide on one. And you've got your little badge on you today, and you must wear that with pride because it's such a fantastic organisation to be involved
in. I know, it's great. I mean, we're members of two organisations, Relais Chateau and Pride of Britain. And but Relais is synonymous with gastronomy, really. And when we did the extensions at North Cove, that was our goal, to become members by 2018, actually, but we managed to get members at 2016. So we circumnavigated it and became members much earlier than we expected. And it just puts you into a collection of hotels that are all punching on a similar level, where food and wine and service is at the right end. I think for guests generally, though, you've got to find a hotel that suits you. Mm. It's a bit like a university. You know, you've got to find one that ticks your DNA. There's no point in going somewhere if you don't like high-level quality service and, you find that a bit stuffy, then some of those properties aren't for you. But if you can find the ones that have got a real heartbeat with a natural understanding, then they'll work for you. We're very, very keen on young people dining at Northcote, of any age, from young tots, really, right the way up. But if you think about a nervous diner coming in at the age of 18 or 22 or 21 or whatever, they want to do this, but they have saved up for it. Yeah. They've not done it before. It's a new experience. So for my staff, those customers are more important than the high net worth Rolls-Royce chauffeur-driven character who does it all his life. Mm. Every time with his wife and his family, he's made his money, this is normal to him, and therefore the expectations are great. with a new customer who's never done it before, it's our job to make sure they have a fab time. They mustn't feel embarrassed. They must feel comfortable with a 700 bottle wine list by saying to them, how can we help you? Well, I don't really know anything about wine. Well, you don't need to do. What do you like at home? What do you normally drink? Mm-hmm. How can we... Well, can I drink beer? Of course you can drink beer. Do you like a lager? Do you prefer a blonde beer? What can we do for you there? I think you've just got to make people think. And when you walk away from the table, when you've done the menu introductions, I can almost feel them go, oh, God, it's not that bad, is it?
Yeah, they've
really helped us, you know.
It is easy to kind of get nervous, especially when you drive in and it's so grand and beautiful and you think, oh God, I'm not gonna...
But you have to remember, all the staff, pretty much all the staff, are under the age of 25.
Yeah.
So they're a youthful bunch who get it because they've been on the other side of the fence as well. Then nobody's interest to make people feel uncomfortable. You've got to make them feel fantastically comfortable. So for me, Raleigh Chateau is great, but you've got to find the right property for the right DNA of you.
Not to say that even... I mean, there's very few that are exactly the same. I'd say none are probably exactly the same.
No, they're all individual.
And that's why I like it, and it always has been an organisation that really fascinates me. And we've been to Midsummer House, obviously we're here today. There's so many great ones around the UK and the world, and it gives you those connections, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, no, it's marvellous for the staff as well, because if they decide to leave us and they want to go travelling, we can place them with the Raleigh Chateau in another country easily. Italy, Spain, Portugal, you know, the Asian areas, wherever they want, you know, New Zealand, Australia, they're all over the world. And it is a fabulous organisation.
Apart from things like that, like you say, this goal to get into Raleigh Chateau, but what makes you really proud?
I think the staff, more than anything, helping people become great. And we take all sorts of young staff who start off nervous, not sure, no confidence, not really ever been in a public arena, having to face things they never faced before. But it takes time to build those characters. And when they leave you and they go off to somewhere else and you meet them in 5, 6, 7 years' time and they're in a position in a hotel and you think, wow, they started with us and they were such a different character. I love that. I love that whole aspect. And then making sure the customers leave happy is the most important thing. Accolades are great if they come along the way, but the most important thing is to have a profitable business and make sure everybody enjoys what you do.
I walked in early and one of your lovely staff members was helping me out, and you came over and said, oh, excuse me, sorry, are you being seen to and helped? And you were so lovely and welcoming. And I wonder, do you always see yourself as the host?
Yeah, always. The staff may see me as interfering. Because I don't
nod.
I don't let go easily. But you can only run the ship if you're at the helm, really. And my theory is you've got to lead from the front and allow the staff the opportunities to make their own decisions and not be cross when things go wrong if they've made a decision. And I hate a decision not being made. That annoys me more than anything. But looking after the customers is what this business is about. It's meat and drink. It is hospitality. Mm. And general managers who live in accountants' towers and don't go down and see their customers, for me, are not true hoteliers. Mm.
And you like, obviously, being on that forefront. I can tell now.
But if everything works at the front, the money will work. Yeah. Trust me. If your customers are happy, the food's great, the service is amazing, everyone leaves the place thinks it's brilliant, everything thinks it's good value for money, although expensive, that's a very clear phrase, I think, you know, your business will definitely work. If you spend so much time trying to refine it into being sterile and passionless, it won't work. And I think that's what can happen.
It's a bit of a cliche question to ask chefs, but it might be an interesting question to ask yourself. In if you go away somewhere and you're staying overnight, do you sort of find yourself thinking, well, that's not quite straight and that's not quite how we would have done it?
don't ask my wife that question. No, to be honest, I think what we tend to do socially now, we try and dine a little bit more casually, because I actually don't need to do that anymore. In my own mind, I know what I like and what I enjoy. Hoteliers, you know, you respect all your fellow hoteliers. They sometimes don't have the financial infrastructure or the availability that some others do. I think as long as the hospitality is genuine, the staff are great, everything else can be forgiven pretty much. So I'm not too difficult to look after, to be honest.
I asked Nigel this question, and I'll ask yourself as well. If there was one chef that you could book for next year's Obsession, who would you like to work with?
Well, I'd probably very difficult question. I'd put a few, really, but Thomas Keller is probably top of my list. Sadly, I've never dined with him. Well, I have at the Manoir, actually, but I've never dined in his restaurant, which I would love to have done, and I still want to do. But I think there are moments in people's careers where you should have done it, and, you know, probably should have done it when they were rising the ladder rather than being at the top of it. But we would love to have Thomas Keller. I think he's the iconic man. I think, yes, Noma, you know, with Rene would be another good one. Mm. That would give you two opposite ends of the spectrum, really. A classical war horse that's cooking amazingly well against someone who's a modernist who's, you know, taken the world by storm and been the new Ferran, really. So, those would be my two picks.
Funny enough, you and Nigel must be on the same wavelength, because he was talking about Copenhagen, and it's one of my favourite places in the world
for
food.
I'd love to go to Geranium.
Oh, do you know what?
Yeah, no, that's I'd love to.
Fantastic. It's so different to Noma. It's just like a... You know, sometimes service, you say it's like clockwork.
Yeah.
It wasn't like clockwork, it was like water, in that it just flowed.
It was perfect.
Please do.
So I was lucky enough to do El Bulli right in the early days when it was on the rise, and that was an amazing experience. I mean, just unbelievable, because it was all new. I mean, we'd done the Fat Duck, so I knew a little bit about that style of cookery, but actually to go to El Bulli and actually have 28 courses and be there on the day before opening, and we were on that trial 2 days where it was just bloody brilliant, you know.
One of the questions that I always ask my guests is to talk about their top foodie tip. I wondered if you had a top wine tip, maybe just the easiest and most effective way of just pairing a wine.
Well, the easiest thing to do is look at the food you're going to eat and decide what country it comes from. That's always a good starting point. So if it's a dish that, say something like osso buco, you know in your mind's eye that an Italian wine is likely to be the best botch for that, because nobody made wine originally to drink in front of the telly. It was all made to drink with food. So you think about so we don't grow a lot of wine in the UK. We're growing a lot more now. But if you think about great Scottish lobsters, you might say, well, that's a good theory, Craig, but lobsters come from Scotland, and as far as I know, there's no vineyards in Scotland. But then I would say, yeah, but what countries in Europe are really famous for lobsters and crabs and seafood? You say, well, Portugal, the coast, the Iberian coast. So what wines do they use for that type of food? Well, they always use Albarino or Alvarinho. And once you've got that in your mind, then you look at those stylings, and then you'll find that right togetherness, because that country will have loved that type of food. So that's how I look at it often. You know, you think about where it comes from, what's the ingredient, what world makes that type of wine, that food come from, and then normally you'll get yourself in the right ballpark.
It's almost more about kind of location then, in a way.
Yeah, well, nobody made wine for... They didn't. They made wine to drink with food. That's what they did. It's only us that now drink it in front of the telly and, you know, large it up in a wine bar for 5 hours. That never happened. You know, you only had wine when you ate food. And principally, that's why every wine really has a pairing somewhere in food.
Do you have one wine pairing that you can give me an example of that you've done and you think, do you know what? 100% perfect.
Well, last night.
Go on then.
Last night we did a ricotta Valpolicella from Algarini, and we served it with a Black Forest gâteau with steeped cherries and from Petrus. And it was the most seamless match that you could put together, because the ricotta, the grapes have been are really sweetened, and it's just, they just taste like cherries, and that's the perfect marriage match rather than a divorce match, if you will. So yeah, last night that actual dessert was a perfect match. You couldn't have bettered it if you tried.
Oh well, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks.
And thank you so much for your warm welcome as well.
It's
earlier.
A great pleasure.
Thank
it's
you.
Okay, and up next, a really great chat with a guy called George Blogg. You will know him. They went to the place on Gravetye Manor on MasterChef a couple of years ago, and we talk about that, and we talk about the sort of lasting impact that's had. And actually, this is only a really small segment of the chat that I had with George, because he's a really, really interesting guy, fantastic talker, fantastic conversationalist. I don't know if I bored him by the end, but I really enjoyed it anyway. So this is a great chat with George. Cheers.
I first became aware of you actually on the MasterChef coverage. That must have been...
It was incredible.
That must have been quite an amazing time, right?
Yeah, it was.
Did it kind of feel like your name went through the roof at that time?
Well, a little bit, but it, I mean, it's. I think it's great for the business, great for my profile to do something like that. But but you've still got to be very aware of how much time you're spending away from your kitchen. But that was sort of very economical in terms of the coverage, because it's massive. It's absolutely massive. So. So they came down. It was only 2 days, so that is really good. So it's, but yeah, it made a big difference to Grave Tie, and I think that the footage they used going over the property just looks incredible.
Yes, that's the one thing that really stood out.
Yeah,
even before they'd sort of announced your name, I was like, oh, this is going to be special, because you could just see it from the property, really.
Yeah, exactly. So and it's very hard to describe something to people through pictures or through social media, but when they see that on the television, it's an instant connection. And then in the kitchen, it was a brilliant experience, but it didn't take too much time out of me being in the restaurant and me operating a restaurant. Other programs would take a lot more time, and I don't want to take my eye off the ball, because the restaurant is what's important.
What's it like for you as the chef in that situation? Because it strikes me that those guys will be really nervous coming into a new kitchen, a steam chef doing really great things, but then maybe you get a little bit nervous as well, because you've got guys in there that you've not worked with before, you've got cameras in there.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, I think we're probably more out of our comfort zone than they are, because we're not used to that. We spend our days in the kitchen cooking. We don't work with there was about 15 of them, I think, that turned up in total. I don't know what they're all doing, but
it's, we're just milling around in the background.
Well, obviously they've all got important roles, but it's two very different sort of industries, doing something together, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, of course you're nervous, because they're filming you, and that is quite scary, really. But I mean, luckily we were so busy that I didn't have time to think about the cameras. We just went for it, and I think that came across, that it was quite natural, and nothing was staged, really, in that service. It was, everything was recorded, and they just recorded what we were actually doing. Everything I said to them was actually saying to them for a reason,
to help them. Well, you wouldn't say this, would you? And they didn't kind of feed you lines.
No feeding of lines at all. So it was all very very natural, which is important as well for me, because I want it to be an honest representation of what we do in the kitchen, and we the way we manage people is quite modern, and we're a very nice kitchen, and you want that to come across as well, as the days of shouting and throwing and they're over, and it shouldn't happen, and you want to nurture young chefs and for them to grow, and if you treat people without any respect, then that won't happen.
And now the tables have turned, and you're the guest in somebody else's kitchen.
Exactly, yeah, which is even more out of my comfort zone in some respects, because the challenge of cooking for, and representing your establishment and your level of cuisine to that many people, is a big challenge. In a foreign kitchen, you've got two teams that haven't worked together before. I've never been to Northcote, it's my first time. An amazing property.
Well, no wonder, because it's quite a journey.
Yeah, well, I lived in Manchester for 4.5 years. I studied there, so it's literally just around the corner. But obviously, being a student, I never knew it existed. Incredible place and an incredible experience. But Lisa and the team are epic. It's a great privilege to come here and to be part of Obsession.
Obviously, there are so many ways that your Grave Tie and Northcote are different, but there are some similarities in the, I remember on that MasterChef episode, the passion for growing and the passion for your produce that you have locally. And
yeah, I mean, we're both Relais Chateau properties, both Pride of Britain properties, we're both hotels which which deal with breakfast, lunch, afternoon tea, dinner. We have tasting menu, a la carte. We have a lunch menu. You know, in some respects, we're quite similar. We're very, very service-led. We want people to have the best possible experience. We both properties are aiming to try and be as luxurious and to offer the best we possibly can. You know, and the investment and the training and the input into that is huge. You know, neither property is happy with just being a certain standard or a certain level. We're all always trying to improve and improve. It's great to be involved with properties who have that same sort of vision. I mean, Northcote is larger than Gravetye, but actually, it's probably sort of two thirds. Gravetye probably about two thirds the size of Northcote, so everything's just scaled down a little bit. You know, bedroom wise, cover wise, in the restaurant. But that service is exactly the same. And the nurturing property of to the younger generation and bringing and training people properly and effectively. I mean, Northcote is second to none, I don't think, in that respect. They put so much effort into the staff. It's so obvious, and that, you know, is so important.
When you're in your own kitchen, no cameras, no events worrying about, what excites you about food when you're in the service and you're plating up? What excites you?
Well, I think the reason you are a chef is because you like giving other people pleasure. So, and I think it's very difficult when you're in a kitchen to love it. Well, it's very difficult to, because everything you pass out should be excellent, and instead of focusing on all those excellent things, which is normally you always focus on the things that aren't good enough, because they're the things you need to improve. So in some ways it's, you're always concentrating on the negatives, but in a very, very positive way. And in my mind, that's what I'm concentrating on in service. Not because I'm not passionate at all about it, but I want those things that aren't so good to be much, much better. But I just, you know, if you've got staff that work with you that are passionate as well about producing things, and they're working hard, they're learning, they're improving, and passing up food which is delicious and cooked exactly how it should be, and it's lovely, and when you have all the systems in place, it just flows, everything goes out well, the customers are happy. I mean, that's incredible. And yeah, and then it's, yeah, it's I suppose there's a bit of the adrenaline of getting ready and preparing yourself for everything. It's a very different world, I think, in a kitchen, but it's amazing to be a part of, I suppose. I think you've just got to keep telling yourself and keep making sure you're always aware that things are brilliant, and when you get a piece of produce in, or for the first time, or and it's incredible, it's such a brilliant feeling to touch it and to smell it and to cook and taste it and to chat with all the other chefs about what we're going to do, why we're doing it, how we're doing it, get input from them as well. But we had some supplier visits, and we work very closely with a lot of local suppliers, same as Northcote, really championing regional produce. And that is incredible, because you get their passion as well, and they're so passionate about those ingredients and what they do on their side of it, and you want to pass that passion through your kitchen to the guest and treat that product with the respect it deserves. So yeah, I mean, it's such an exciting sort of environment to be in, I suppose.
I still view you, from what I know of you, as a young chef. You're still rising. You know, you're still fulfilling your potential, which is so obvious. And I wonder if, as much as an event like this raises your profile, which is great, it also gives you a chance to learn more as well.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, everyone says you can't stop learning, and why would you want to stop? I mean, I'm actually here for the rest of Obsession. I'm lucky that Grave Tie shut for 4 months. We're having a massive refurbishment project, new restaurant, new kitchen, to allow us to grow and improve. And being here and working with all these chefs and being in the kitchen is a really good chance for me to, you know, to learn and develop as a chef as well. I mean, it's such an incredible site, such an incredible place. And you know, people like Lisa and Nigel and Craig are, you know, such important role models in the industry, and to learn from them and see how they operate and it's a fantastic experience. So
what you're obviously trying to do when you come to an event like this, like you've already alluded to, is your menu, you're trying to give like a taste of Grave Tie, right?
Yeah.
So would you be able to talk me through one of the dishes that you had on your menu for Obsession?
Yeah, so we had the first course, celeriac dish, so very representational of what we do, especially in the winter months. We only use our own sort of vegetables from the garden, and you have a lot less growing, so you have to do more with each product, whereas in the summer months you might have 4 or 5 different types of vegetables on the plate. So we just have a dish just made up of the celeriac predominantly, with a few other things added in, but we have to make the dish interesting, to make it exciting, you have to vary the textural components, and we do that, and the complexities of flavour, we do that by preparing the celeriac in lots of different ways, which is not unusual, but it's such a lovely way to do things. But we've got an celeriac ash mayonnaise, we smoke the celerics as well, we have a crushed caramelised celeriac, a piece of the smoked celeriac baton, we pickle a disc and roll it into a funnel shape and pipe it with a local cow's curd, which we also smoke. The smokiness really, really adds to the dish. Serving also with some black truffle and some hazelnut in other forms as well. Some celeriac leaf, a little celeriac leaf gremolata. It's just, I mean, essentially it's quite a simple dish, I suppose. But it's just delicious, and when you have
it sounds it
when you have a vegetarian dish, which you eat it and you don't even think it's vegetarian, you're not missing meat, you're not missing fish, it's everything about it is lovely, and they're the dishes that I really get really love cooking, because when you read a dish like that, no one expects it to be great, no one expects it to knock them over, they always go for the big things, the lobster, the turbot, you know, the expensive, luxurious ingredients, and it's such a humble way. Yes, we put the truffle on it, but it's not, you know, it's not on there in en masse. It's a tiny part of it.
It's like a nod to luxury.
Yeah, but it's such a delicious dish, and as I said, the expectations of that. Especially the first course are probably quite low. People are probably looking forward to other parts of the menu. They get that and bang, and that's really, really good.
I talk to a lot of my guests about styles of food, and again, watching that MasterChef segment and then following your career since, I'm not going to use the word style, I'm going to use the word identity. It felt like your food has a very strong identity. I wondered if that was kind of easy to come to, if it's like a natural process.
Well, it's quite difficult, I suppose. I mean, I don't think of an identity to try and put my food into.
No.
But you just cook a certain way, and your background, your experiences, everything sort of merges into that final product. And even the food at Grave Tie has progressed considerably since I've been there. And I don't see that changing at all. I think as I progress as a chef and learn and develop, and hopefully my food becomes more refined or more exact and more flavoursome. And so that I think it's just a continual adaptation, and I think it's just your style, I suppose, is just representation of what you like to cook and how you like to eat it, and and really thinking about the people you're cooking for and the environment you're cooking in. I mean, that's key, I think. And there are a lot of chefs, I think, that do cook food they really want to eat, but almost alienate their guests. And you know, in a hotel, just like Northcote, we have to cook for guests that aren't necessarily coming just to eat my food. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're coming for the whole experience, and I mean, my food is one part of that, but you know,
a very big part.
Well, yeah, I mean, but you know, you can't be so arrogant to presume that. But
I'll be arrogant on your behalf.
Oh, thank you. But
because your food looks amazing, so
no, thanks. But yeah, I mean, it's and looks as well is something strange, because you know the way we work is flavour is key. Flavour is the first thing we think about. After that, close behind is texture, and presentation is a. You know, almost an afterthought. It's you know, even at Obsession week, you know, the night before, we were still deciding on how we were going to present a dish, because that's the last thought process of you know. But months and months and months before we decided on the flavours and the textural elements, it was like, but how we actually present it.
But funnily enough, that kind of almost backs up in my head what I have about your food, is that the presentation is natural, so probably therefore doesn't need to be so much thought about.
You know, if you're using a vegetable, you still want it to look like a vegetable. You're not trying to create something different out of something that of something else. It's so I mean, I hate pretension. And I'm not really that fond of gimmicks, and I think there's a fine line between gimmicky food and food which actually has things there for a reason. So I mean, and especially service wise as well, pretension for me is just I hate it. You know, it's like. You know, we're lucky to have a very friendly sort of but professional sort of service team at Grave Tie, and exactly the same at Northcote as well. But yeah, I mean, the style is difficult, I think. I struggle to define my own style, actually, and to be honest, other people talking, eating my food and telling me what my style is actually is probably helps me to understand it, because I'm just doing it, and maybe I'm not the best person to put into words what that style is, so it's nice to hear other people.
Do you know why I didn't use that word? Is because I've done a lot of interviews now with chefs.
Yeah.
I'm getting more and more and more involved in the industry, and I used to say style, and chefs would say, it's just tasty. My style of food is to make tasty food.
Yeah.
And so that's why I said identity, because all the pictures that I see, I can see some kind of commonality, which is essentially you.
Yeah,
that's why I use that word. Do you see?
Yeah. No, exactly.
The difference that I'm sort of trying to make.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose cooking flavors and food is what you're aiming to do, really, isn't it? And a style isn't something I aim towards at all. An identity isn't something I aim towards. An identity is actually just what you are, isn't it?
Yes.
But I suppose I have core values which determine that style and that identity. I suppose it doesn't matter what you call it, essentially.
Yes.
And for me, it's almost like a bubble of what will work and what fits into those values and what wouldn't. You know, there's no point in me working at Grave Tie and making a banana souffle. I mean, or you know, yes, it's lovely, but it doesn't. There's no story. There's no connection, and so we really draw on our region and the produce we grow, and I try to input that into everything we do. I think it's very difficult for chefs to do that in some cases, and I've got friends who are chefs who hate being restricted, who hate being but having other things determine what they put on their menu, because they just want access to any ingredient, they want to prepare anything at any time of the year almost. But I actually love being restricted by what I do, and I love the fact that our garden essentially determines the ingredients we use, and the gardeners to that extent almost write the menu for me.
Yes.
And what they grow is what we use, and we're just the people that sort of put the puzzle together of okay, we're using that vegetable, we're pairing it with that piece of protein, or and we're cooking it in this way. So yeah, you just put, there's a big puzzle that you're just putting together. I mean, time and place is hugely important to me. So the food has to be representation of what time of year it is and exactly where you are in the country, or you know, and the environment we're in. And that, I think that's key, especially being, say, part of Relais Château and the championing regional produce, championing individuality and properties. And whether we're in it or not, that's really what I want to do, because you don't want to be, it's not that you don't want to be the same as anywhere else, but you just want to really work hard at something that makes you stand out, I suppose, or something that makes you who you are. And yeah, so time and place is key. And as you said, exactly, that a natural plating style. I use white crockery predominantly. Very plain, simple white crockery, and I believe it really makes this food stand out. And again, it's down to maybe that pretension and that gimmickiness. I think also it helps because Gravetye is an institution in some respects, and a nod to its classical heritage. But although it's been pioneering in the same way as well. I mean, when it opened the hotel, it was, you know, a pioneering move to have a country house hotel at, you know, all of them were being opened in London, so it was a bit of a crazy idea at the time. And then the gardener there as well, a pioneering gardener, developed the English country sort of style of garden as we know it. So hugely influential, pioneering people have been at Gravetye, but I suppose because it's been around for so long, people look at it as a sort of a classical institution. I suppose gastronomically it has been as well. So not a nice nod to that, but I really believe it lifts the food just being on simple white plates. And again, the gimmicky factor, I don't feel the need to have a stoneware styled plate or plates with lots of things put on them before the food goes down.
It's almost like you're giving yourself nowhere to hide in a way.
Exactly, you are, yeah. But I like that because it challenges you to make the food everything. There's nothing else there. The food is everything. And if you can't challenge yourself enough to make that look good without having to put it on a plate that does that for you in some respects, I don't know, I think it's a stronger message.
Do you know what interests me is, I pulled up at the front earlier and I pulled past you and I saw you, and obviously I've been invited to cover a couple of days for this event, and one of the days wasn't your day, but I know I'm a slight exception to the rule because I obsess about chefs, but I recognised you straight away, and in the meantime, I've not been sitting here making notes and thinking, oh, I'm going to talk to George later. This conversation is just on what I've thought about your restaurant. I have a clear opinion in my head of what I think of your food and your style and why you're so special, and I wonder if that's like a gift or a curse. Do you see what I mean? In that I know so much about you, but I may be guilty of, like, I'm putting you in a box, and I wonder if that kind of spreads throughout the industry almost.
I don't know. I mean, I think you have to be strong enough as a character to just do what you feel is right and not be driven by what people expect from you. I mean, really, our goal should be quite simple. It's my job is if someone comes to Gravetye and eats food, I want them to have a great experience, and that's it. I mean, and that's what really drives me, you know. That's my goal. I'm not, and in some ways, that if that's all you concentrate on, then that should and will be achievable. I think people can get caught up in cooking for accolades, or cooking to prove something, or cooking to change opinions about food, or or to educate their guests in a way that they feel it should be right. There's very few people in the world that can do that. So, you know, I'm not one of those people, I don't think. We cook food that hopefully people will just enjoy to eat and makes their stay at Gravetye incredible. So,
well, all I can say is what a real treat that I did drive past you today, and it's been such a pleasure to chat to you. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Cheers.
So lastly, was the guy who very kindly invited me to Obsession, Nigel Howarth's son, Kirk. A really great guy, and actually a really interesting story that's going to be uncovered here about his health problems and why he cooks in the way that he does. And he's opened up his first restaurant now in London, which is called Plates, and it's a ticketed restaurant. And you know what, it looks really interesting, and on the food that we were discussing and that he was cooking, I think it will be one actually to watch. So yeah, have a little listen and see what you think.
It's pushy in here, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is it nice to come back?
Yeah, it always is, yeah.
Is it good memories?
Yeah.
Not stressful memories.
No. Well, yeah, we've had some bloody tough nights, yeah, but it's life, isn't it?
Do you think you were always going to be a chef?
I don't. From when I was younger, I never wanted to be, and then I started pot washing about the age of 14, and then it was all a bit. I got offered if I wanted to do like the canapés on the weekend, and it felt like a promotion to me. So then I kind of just thought, God, it's better than washing pots, I'll do that. And then I never really looked back. And then I just kind of absorbed it all, and I loved the buzz, and then I just got addicted to it.
It must be difficult though sometimes, because you might feel like there's a sort of shadow.
Yeah, I think
looming above you.
You know, I'll be honest, when I went to London at 19, I had a lot of trouble with a lot of chefs, you know, in terms of you're only here because of your dad, and you only got the job in, you know, Too Much Star restaurant because of your dad, and I think that really let that beat me up for a long time. And now you have to become strong and you have to become resilient, and I think there's always some people that want to put you down and stuff, so you have to really believe in what you're doing and ignore those people and just push yourself, because there's so many positives out of it. And yeah, I think that's the most important thing. And me myself, I know that, you know, what I'm doing with Plates now is completely coming from me, with, you know, obviously my sister's part of the business, but you know, my dad isn't backing it, my dad isn't a part of it at all, so no one can say that, you know, Plates wouldn't be where it is about your dad, because it's completely, we've done it on our own. So, and I think that's what I always wanted to do. I never wanted to, you know, be that person that kind of, oh, he's got everything given, because that's not how my dad is. My dad brought me up to work for your own stuff, you know, and graft. So I think that's,
I suppose as well, what I was thinking is, it as there must be a bit of it that's been a shadow, which we've discussed, but there must also be a bit that pushes you, because then you want to prove yourself in your own right.
Yeah, I think definitely, I think there's a positive and a negative with that. I think pushing yourself too much, which I did, for that reason, because I always had the pressure of, I wanted to make my dad proud, number one, and the pressure of everybody else. It's, you know, it's like anything, if your dad's a chef, they expect you to be as good as him. They expect you to be good, don't they? And I don't think that's a reasonable thing, really, is it? Because we're all individuals.
It's about creating your identity, yeah, and it seems like you really are doing that with Plates.
Yeah, and it's about being you, isn't it? And yeah, I think it's just it's interesting, but I've got to look at all the positives that my dad, being who he is, brings, and take those, and, you know, and really, you know, push those with, in a positive way.
So what was the sort of light bulb moment behind coming up with the idea of doing Plates?
So basically, I was suffering about for the last 6 years with a lot of chronic pain, a lot of other symptoms, invisible symptoms. So I was working in the kitchen, really struggling with fatigue, balance, memory confusion and brain fog and stuff like that. And I knew there was something really wrong, but we couldn't work out what it is. It took about 4 years, and 2 years ago I got diagnosed with Lyme disease. And then it was actually really relieving to know what I had, because then we could try and treat it. From stabbing in the dark and doctors saying take these drugs, take them drugs, double this drug, double that drug. And that was, I went 4.5 years with that, and I never ever expressed that, never put that, we kept it very, very quiet. And I dealt with all the pain on my own. Well, that's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know, but I never wanted to be that chef that was always moaning. And I just carried on working, and basically I got to a point when I was at SATS, I had to stop. I was 9 months in, and I was literally, I was like a zombie. I just couldn't function anymore properly. I weren't thinking straight. My pain was through the roof, and I had to stop. And then basically I looked into, when I got diagnosed with Lyme, I looked into the power of diet and how you can control your pain and your symptoms with food and other things. I'm not saying that food can cure illness, although it has been done before, but it definitely aids and it definitely helps my pain. So then for me to then carry on cooking, to be able to, you know, as a chef, you have to be able to eat those dishes. So if I'm going to, I've got to be able to cook something that I can eat. Now, if I cook, say, you know, a really rich red meat dish or something, it makes me really, it makes me worse, and it inflames my pain. So, you know, that wouldn't be a smart thing to do. So cooking the way I am now is basically inspired by my diet and the journey that's naturally happened. So then I'm basically cooking all plant-based, and as organic as possible.
We were talking about that before, and we were talking about this idea of plant-based, because what you don't want, and certainly what I've seen, it isn't, vegan is a really overused word. It is vegan, obviously, naturally, but there are
sometimes you have to say it's vegan.
Yeah.
But we don't call it vegan, we call it plant-based.
Yeah. And one of the tropes that you're really keen to not get involved in is all this fake bacon, fake burgers.
Yeah, exactly. And again, I think I'm just cooking me. I don't look at anybody else. Everything that I cook is personal. So whether it's a dish that I've cooked at home, and then I'll take that dish and make it a dish that I can use at plates. It's something that's very, very simple. Whether it's, you know, a sweet potato, and make it into something delicious, more delicious from what I eat at home. And that's what a lot of the ideas are inspired by. You know, I'm really passionate about making good soups and broths, and because they're really delicious and good for the gut. So I always concentrate on making a delicious soup at plate. And everything's personal. Like, there's no, I think a lot of chefs, obviously it's great to be inspired by chefs, but I think, you know, taking ideas from cookbooks and all that, I don't think sometimes it's necessarily your own. And this has forced me, and it's tough sometimes, I think, God, could I just cook like normally? But it forces maximum creativity, because it pushes you in a corner with minimal ingredients, and you have to create something that's completely new.
Is the idea as well not just to challenge yourself, but to challenge the diner as well?
Yeah, I want meat eaters to come, I want people that eat everything to come and not even notice that they've missed meat. That's the aim. I'm not just cooking for vegans, I'm not just cooking for plant-based stuff for those people. Obviously, that is, you know, another reason why I'm doing it, is because I think nowadays there's a lot of people with massive dietaries and intolerances, and I think when they go out now, they're kind of a bit burdened, because they're a bit, you know, oh, I'm intolerant to this, I'm intolerant to that, and they feel a bit obliged, you know, to keep saying in a restaurant while their friend's eating all the menu steak and all the rest of it. So it's basically, they can come feel extra special, not even say anything about the dietaries, because it's all basically cooked for that reason.
So we're talking today in Northcote as a part of the Obsession events, which you've been a part of. You did the penultimate night with your friend Nelly, who runs Nell in Australia. It's Melbourne in Australia,
Sydney.
Isn't it? Sydney. Yeah. My apologies, in Sydney in Australia. You've known him since your time from Northcote.
Yeah, we grew up together since 12, and then we cooked together as apprentices here at Northcote.
How great was it to cook together?
Amazing. I think food's so, like, you can touch emotions and you can connect with people so much, and it just brings so much joy and happiness. And actually, it's my place that when I deal with a lot of pain and stuff, a kitchen really takes my mind off the pain, even though I shouldn't necessarily be working as much as I do sometimes. I really find that it's the best place for me, for my mind. I find it's, I just love it. I would live in a kitchen if I could.
So how did you two decide what courses you would take?
I think it's I think it worked naturally really well because obviously he cooks all sorts of, you know, food inspired a lot, quite a lot from Asia and stuff, but obviously he cooks proteins and fish and all that sort of thing, so it kind of just alleviated naturally. I said I wanted to do a couple of my classics at plates and he wanted to do some others, and then it was just fitting those in the little boxes that work together as a nice menu.
And was it really, was it a quite a proud moment to be here in Obsession, a really renowned event for your dad, and stand up as your own self?
Yeah, exactly. It was, I think for the last 5 years, me and Nelly have always said, like, you know, our goal is to do Obsession. So it's a career goal, it really is.
Who have you been able to enjoy any of the other chefs' nights?
I did a bit, I ate on Tommy Banks' night.
Yes.
But because of my dietaries, obviously I didn't get to try his full experience.
Of course, yeah, of course.
I worked on the Russia day, on the Russia night, but I didn't eat at night time. But I saw a lot of the dishes. And again, it's inspiring, you know, you can take something from Russia and turn it into a plant-based plant-based, you know, idea or something. So that's really inspiring to see other chefs do other things.
And, you know, again there, it must be that every time a chef's coming into this kitchen, every time you're faced with a chef, you know, like you say, you can't do everything that they're doing, so you have to look for ways of, so that's what you're saying about the creative, isn't it? It's always about looking for ways of,
yeah dishes are really hard to get right. They take weeks and months of not just thinking but then creating and actually doing, and they take so much perfection. You know, if you 5 or 6 gram out on something, it can make a massive difference, you know, when you're not using sugar and using natural sugars. And that's, for instance, on desserts. And it's the same with making, you know, I make a beautiful black trumpet sauce on my celeriac and truffle lasagna, and it's no dairy. But the boys were trying it last night, and they couldn't believe that it was no dairy. Because you get sweetness and you get richness from other things, and that, I think that's a real, another thought process you have to make. Before you make the sauce, you have to really think about it, where a chef that's classically trained has that embedded in them, and they just make the sauce and it's beautiful, you know, when you've got all the ingredients to play with. But this is, you know, there's a lot more planning basis before you actually go for it. So it's not just about idea and cook.
Mm. We talk me through it. Talk me through how you go about doing it.
Yeah, so it's then looking at what vegetable gives richness, sweetness, and all those sort of things, and getting the richness from those ingredients. So, you know, and oils, actually making a lot of the soups and stuff, I've found that actually the flavour and the purity is so much cleaner, and so much, I think the flavour's a lot better without butter. I think so many chefs now are just piling butter in and in everything, and it actually masks the flavour. Yeah, it might be delicious, but are you tasting butter or are you tasting the vegetable? If you beautifully cook something in a really delicate olive oil, really, really slowly for a long amount of time, and really care about it, you know, whether it's just sweating off some shallots, you know, I sweat the shallots off for 6 hours for the trumpet sauce, and that's really important. If you sweat them off for an hour, the sauce is not the same, because those shallots release sweetness, and the oil together with it leaves richness, and then once that splits together, it creates a smoothness, which then the finished article is a silky black trumpet sauce. So there's layers of it that starts from the very beginning.
So that's just a case of having the onions in a pan, really low heat, and just leave them there.
It's like anything, it's about giving it complete attention. You can't rush stuff. It's the same with, I make a shiitake broth and it takes me 3 days. I think that's what people misunderstand as well. Like, a lot of people think, vegetarian, it's cheap, so it's good for your GP and stuff, but they're missing it takes so much more labour, so much more time, so much more thought, and to get that flavour takes a lot. So I think a lot of people coming to plates now are appreciating that, actually, so it's really inspiring, really.
Funny enough, some people that I was chatting to today, actually, they were talking about, they do have, like, they run like a vegetarian foraging course, and they were saying actually sometimes having meat in a dish can restrict you, because you're restricted to the pairings of things that go with that,
with meat, because meat's meat, the dominant flavour,
right?
Yeah,
so you must not have that problem.
No, I think like I say, there's you know, that is a very positive, I think there's so many positives with cooking vegetables as well. I think that is one of them, that you've nowhere to hide when you cook, when you cook just vegetables. You know, if you cook a, if you have an incredible piece of, say, let's say marbled Wagyu beef, and it's like blow away, and you're serving it with some truffles, and then you serve, you know, let's say some cabbage with it, or it's a piece of beetroot. If that cabbage and beetroot's okay, not great, it doesn't matter, because that Wagyu stole the show, and people forget the cabbage because. But when you're just going to serve someone a roasted cabbage, you've nowhere to hide. So that has to be cooked perfectly. And it's the same as cooking a piece of fish or anything. There's a way, you can overcook vegetables and it's ruined. And you can undercook it and it's inedible. So there's a skill and a temperature approach with all these things. And I've started actually temperature probing a lot of vegetables now, like you would a piece of meat. So it's about using the techniques that you would with these ingredients and doing it with vegetables.
You know, you... So you've been open since March, you said, in place?
So it's going to open in March. I've been doing residences in London for the last 8 months.
Wow. So you're not, we're not open, we're not running yet. We're literally
3rd of March,
it.
We're just building everything. So, it opens permanent.
What's the sort of recipes that you've got in your head at the minute that you're most excited about plating up?
I've worked on a lot of new ones. So I've spent the last 2 months doing a licorice bread, which I'm really, really happy about. I failed many, many times making it, so I'm very proud of it now. So that's really, really good. And I think I'm going to keep, you know, the problem is obviously with the season, so I've got quite a few classics now, but they're going just probably now. Obsession was my last time I was using them. So it's about now doing new dishes for the new season, just coming into spring, leaving March. So there's some new dishes and then some classics. You know, I do a coconut yogurt that was inspired by me... having to quit refined sugars in all areas of my diet, because refined sugars feed disease and illness, and I started to just buy loads of coconut yogurt and get addicted to it. I just loved it, and then I started to read into how I can make my own, and that took me a good couple of months to get right. So I make my own yogurt. I have a yogurt incubator which holds yogurt 40 degrees with a natural probiotic, and that sits in there for 10 hours. And then it's about then making the yogurt and then making it, putting my spin on it. So I serve it with, I make a cacao ganache which also takes 3 days, with bananas, organic, 100% organic cacao powder, and the inside from coconuts is a caramel, to get a little bit of sweetness. And I emulsify it with olive oil and salt, a tiny pinch of salt. And I serve that with wild meadow sweet and sour apple. And then it's making a dish that's then relates in a refined dining way, which people can say, you know, they can tell where I've kind of, where my background is, and, you know, the skill level. But taking something so simple as a yogurt.
Way more complex than I even realised. Yeah. Like, the processes. Where have you learned all of, you know, all of these processes and ideas and temperatures and time?
I think a lot of people ask that. I think it's almost basically... starting again. It's like being an apprentice all over again. So you've got to forget, you know, when you get taught how to cook a scallop perfectly, or how to cook a piece of fish perfectly, or a piece of meat perfectly, and you spend a lot of time making incredible meat sauces. Like, my dad's a king at meat sauces, so I learned a lot about that. And then it's about, you got to almost forget, I'm on a new journey now. Every day I'm learning, every day I'm researching, every day I'm writing ideas down, when I'm on the train, on the bus, anything. And then just trying them. So it's not like I can take ideas from chefs, because I'm not saying this in a big headed way, but I don't think there's a chef with my background doing what I'm doing.
No.
And I think you've got to, you know, be confident when you say that and say, that's what I'm going to do and that's what I believe in.
There are chefs, out there that have allergies and intolerances to certain things. I know, I remember watching Great British Menu and Tom Kerridge can't have shellfish and stuff like that. But, I've never heard of somebody who has such a, you know, a real impact on themselves. Like, the description of what you're saying there, where you're just hazy and it, you know.
And I think it's because it's so internal, I think it's kind of gets overlooked. I think obviously people, you know, deal with the problems differently. And I think if you can't see it, they don't believe it sometimes. Yes. And I think, you know, I think the world's changing now when it's mental health. I think the chef industry is phenomenal. I mean, I cannot thank the people that have helped. Plates would not be where it is now if I haven't had the chefs that I've worked with in the past who in their own right are Michelin stars now, have come to plates and helped me for free because they know I've struggled with fatigue and you know, I can't lift heavy things and stuff like that. And they've come and helped me get plates set up, and I'm really, like, admirable for the industry. I think it's incredible.
Well, I have to say, learning more about it today, I'm really excited about it opening in March. You've got Twitter pages set up, you've got websites set up for everybody to look it up.
Yeah, exactly. So the plates website, where you can buy the it's all going to be ticketed dinners. So it's at www.plates-london.com.
Perfect.
And then Instagram is @plates_London. Same on Twitter, and Facebook is Plates London.
Perfect. And I'll put all the links out through the podcast. Yeah, I'll tweet out to yourself as well, so you've got the links. Thank you so much for organising time at Obsession. I've loved it. Good luck with plates. It sounds amazing.
Thank you.
So there we go. That was the first ever episode back of Series 3. Wow. Obsession. What a fantastic event. I'm hoping, you never know, that I've got my face in there now, that along with 7 chefs, we could sort of do things like that yearly and just pop up and meet different people from Obsession and see how it transforms. But you never know, they might be sick of me. Anyway, so there's loads coming up this series, and over to me with a very exciting announcement. Take it away, me. Thank you, Paul. Or thank you, me, I should say. So, yeah, exciting announcement time. As promised, I'm going to start telling you who we've got coming up next week at the end of each episode. So it's worth, at the end of each one, tuning to the very end to hear a little special message from me, like the one I'm going to give you right now. So next week, we went all the way down to Padstow in Cornwall to interview none other than, well, you've probably guessed it, it's Paul Ainsworth. Yes, so Paul Ainsworth's going to be my guest next week. Tune in then to listen to a fantastic chat with the legendary Mr. Ainsworth. Really looking forward to that one. Cheers, guys. Series 3 of the Past podcast is, as always, edited by Adam Linder from Bespoken Podcasting, Craig Fields from Ambient Light, and now the fantastic podcast Is It Worth It provides technical support, and my good friend Ruby Chow helps me out with all the bookings. Thanks to all the team.